Today we have a very special guest, Rob Higgins, and it's a film around the world. I think you just finished this film the other day, and he sent it to me. Isn't that awesome? Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This film is actually, it's been a few years in the making. I did just do the final render the other day, where there's that old saying where films aren't released, they escape. You know, it's just, you stop tinkering on it, and somebody had brought up that I had spelled something wrong in the credits, so it's literally just making sure that the credits were good and everything else. My wife also wanted something out of the credits. She didn't want the film to be associated with our previous LLC.
Sorry, what's an LLC? I'm going to stop you right there.
The LLC?
Yeah, what is that? I don't know.
Local liability company.
Thank you.
Just many years, but we sort of limped along like we were Snagit Studios. I really liked it, you know, used it. I really wanted to use it as a sort of an arm in terms of branding and things like that, but it just was not to be for tax purposes, that's all.
Oh, see, that's an interesting story. I didn't know that. Why did your film take so long to make?
The film started out as it started sort of weirdly back with my first film that we made in 2010. And essentially we made a $1 million film, I think, with our first film for $12,000, basically. We made this film over 17 days, which is kind of unheard of in terms of, like, something for such a low budget. And we had dozens of speaking parts and extras and, you know, I think one day we had over 100 people on set.
Wow.
And it just was a lot. And afterwards, I sort of realized that we had cracked the code of indie filmmaking of, like, what to do, what not to do, what you can do with resources and things like that. And because She's in the Details was made for $12,000, a lot of it was made on a favor budget. And I sort of burned all those bridges where it was just, you know, you can – for the next one, people are really just want paid. And so I took what we had learned and I was like, well, if I can make what looks like a $1 million film for $12,000, I can certainly make a film, let's say $50,000 film for like $2,000. So that was my initial thing, was like, how do I make a film for $2,000? And then, we just through like screenwriting design and knowing what I had to play with, I was able to take that and actually scale that up a bit to $4,000, and that's sort of where we bottomed out. So when we made that film, it just it was just a lot of things all at once. But then it was part of a bigger plan to, with another project that I had that was, it was designed to be sort of like, here's what we can do for very small amount of money. Here's what this is. Here's what where our talents lie. And now here's this much bigger project, that we can sort of build on the bedrock of around the world. But in the middle of that project, the second project, it sort of exploded in my face. I nearly went through a divorce.
Ouch.
And everything sort of just blew up in my face right around 2015. And so it just sat for a little while I pursued screenwriting. Sort of in the interim, I actually gave up indie film for a little bit, and I stopped shooting, and I stopped doing really anything of that sort, and I just focused on screenwriting for a while.
Wow, that's intense, man.
Yeah, it was a fun few years. Like, we made the film, and we're very proud of it, and then, like I said, we had this big plan. I think the problem is that the plan was much bigger than I was, and I thought that I would be able to build something much bigger off of Around the World than was realistically possible. And, you know, when you make a $4,000 movie, you're going to have to sort of temper your expectations. No matter how good it looks or no matter how good you think it is, you're just going to have to temper your expectations. And I felt like I just let those get away from me, and I ended up in this place where I had attempted something that was much bigger than myself, and that led to some problems. And then I just sort of had to let all that sort of sit and marinate. And coming to this year, where I wanted to focus on putting out a body of work more in a sort of instructional capacity, where it's like, you too can make films for no money. And I thought, what better way to start off with than a movie that we made for $4,000? And I sat down at the end of last year, and I took a look at the film, and I was still very proud of the work that we had accomplished in 4 days, where we literally, you know, just burn through with no second takes or no second chances, and we just put that film together. And I looked at it and I was like, wow, this is really good. And I just thought that would be a perfect way to sort of like start off the year.
Wow, good work. Okay, well, let's get into your film. Before we start, how did you do your casting? Because you have some very interesting characters.
Well, my lead actor is a friend of mine. His name is Paul Mide, and he's literally my favorite actor of all time. He and I met when we were both going to community college, and we sort of stayed in touch over the years. And we've done all kinds of shorts and things together, and I should really never make anything without Paul, because he just gets my scripts. He sort of gets the pacing and the tone, and he's probably the actor that I've had to direct the least. So, like, Paul's the type of actor that you're going to put him in a scene, you're going to get exactly what you were intending on the page 95% of the time.
That's awesome.
So
that's really cool.
That's where I sort of started with him, and I was like, okay, well, I want to work with Paul. And I wanted to work with another actress, and so I sort of started there. And I wrote the script to those actors, and then the actress that I had wanted to work with dropped out. And I don't know if it was a problem with the script. We never really sort of – it just was made known to me that she wasn't interested in making the movie. So Paul and I went back to the drawing board, and we tried to cast as quickly as we could, because we had a deadline. And we went through over 200 actresses.
Oh my
God. For female lead, and we just couldn't find anybody. And then Paul found someone that I guess he had met and was doing a play in Los Angeles, and sent her the script. And because she knew Paul, it sort of clicked with her, and the two of them just sort of used their relationship. And we did some Skype meetings, sort of Skype auditions and Skype meetings, and then she turned out to be it. And when Lauren joined the project, she just, made it. She just, it was clearly her role all along. We just didn't know it. And because the two of them were both in Los Angeles, they were both able to rehearse on it without me. And that made things a lot easier, because I had to fly them both completely across the country to shoot. And I only had like a really long weekend to do that. So all of the rehearsal time was conducted on their own terms. So I was really grateful for that.
But you're missing Seymour. Where did you find Seymour?
Well, Seymour, I went through a couple of different people that would eventually, that I thought would be a great fit for the role, but eventually it just came down to I couldn't trust anyone. When you're doing something with a budget that small and such a tight schedule, like I didn't want anybody to screw me over, and so I just sort of Hitchcocked myself into that role or Shyamalan myself into that role.
So you're Seymour.
Yeah, so I'm
Seymour. Oh, see, I had no idea because I can't see you, so I don't know.
That's me, unfortunately. I really hated that. I was, you know, it was a thank God for me. I have a really brilliant camera and cinematographer in Nick Jackson, and he was sort of directing those scenes because I couldn't. And it was just me and Paul. Like I said, Paul can get the best reactions out of anyone. So I made sure that all my scenes were with Paul. So I knew that even if, you know, I'm not an actor by any stretch of the imagination, but like, you know, if, at least in every scene that I'm in, there's at least one really good actor on screen. Yeah.
Okay. And you have one more character we can quickly discuss, the bartender.
Yeah, that's actually my friend Tom. I worked in Armored Car for many years, and my friend Tom Hafler, he was my partner for many years, and we watched each other's backs, and he sort of gets these little cameo roles in my movie. He had a cameo role in my first movie, She's in the Details, and I put him in this cameo role in this movie as well. He had a T-shirt that also was advertising the beer company that allowed us to use their beers in the film. So it was just sort of a little shout out to him. He's great. His reactions are hysterical, I love Tom. He's like a really good friend and. We used to actually be neighbors as well as partners, and our kids would play together and that sort of thing. So it's just Tom being Tom in that little tiny role.
Okay, so let's get into your film. You start off with a scene, a domestic scene. The babysitter I did want to discuss.
Yeah.
She seems a little old to be a babysitter.
She does, and that's sort of a consequence of casting. I mean,
I thought so.
Like I said, we did, eventually, like, you know, when you do this filmmaking thing for long enough, you have a lot of friends who are actors. And, Amy came in, she'd been in our, previous film, and I love working with Amy. So, she came into it with, the right attitude. And I thought, if nothing else, she had this sort of, I thought she could pull it off acting-wise, but she did look a little bit old for the role. But introducing, like, you know, someone younger might have had bigger problems that might have shown up. It was a very tight schedule, and you needed people to be able to hit their marks, do the lines, and go. And the other thing is that once we got her on set, she had amazing chemistry with Paul. And so there was no stopping it. I thank her for showing up. I mean, it's one of those things kind of like everything was what you can have access to and what you can do with for free, as much as you can for free.
Of course.
And yeah, so I think even though she didn't have technically, like, you know, 100% the right look for the part, she came in and I think she nailed it. And I always give myself a chance to work with Amy.
I don't want to say she did a bad job. I think she did a great job. I thought her lines were crisp. I thought she had a good line delivery. She worked very well with Paul. I will fully give you that. I thought she was a little bit of a digger, like the gossip for the area.
Yeah.
I hope she was supposed to come off like that because that's how I took her. I'm very much of a giver and maybe a little too much of a sharer.
Yeah, Sherry, I mean, I think in the original script, I was sort of writing her as almost like a sexy tease. But Amy was able to play her as like this aloof gossip like the way that she played the role gave it a lot more life than I think it was actually on the page. She played it with this very much aloofness. Like she knew that she sort of had sort of like power of sexuality, but not necessarily how to use it like properly. And then some of it is just, you know, just creepy old man syndrome sort of from Paul, but the two of them just play off of it, I think, in the right way. And she just, like I said, the thing could have just fell flat on the page. There's so much of that dialogue where it's just chewing scenery, but I think Amy just brought so much life to it. And I laugh all the way through her lines. All of her lines are extremely hysterical.
They are. They're very good.
She just delivers them.
I never took Paul as the creepy old man, ever.
Well, I mean, there's a scene where like he's like looking at her legs, and he's just like, okay, that's...
Yeah.
He
looked more uncomfortable to me. And me being a parent, I thought he was more uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think he is too. And it just sort of, it's one of those situations where like you realize that you're older than someone or like, you know, you find yourself in this situation where you're just like, okay, that's maybe not appropriate, but you know, you find yourself in these kind of weird situations. I remember this, it sort of brings back this sort of situation for me where I remember I was at a birthday party for a kid. And it was a costume party because it was around Halloween. And one of the mothers there had recently had her breasts enhanced. And so she wore this costume that would accentuate that. And I remember being at this and be like, this is completely inappropriate for a child's birthday party, but here you are.
Yeah.
Like, it's just that kind of moment where I think that's, you know, that I love those kind of like, uncomfortable, real life moments where just sort of like what you want to say and what you can say sort of meet reality.
Yeah,
and then what happens after that.
I want to discuss some of your musical choices. Where do they come from? Because they're very distinct noises. I don't know if it's really songs, but more like sounds. Yeah,
they are all the music in there is done by Benjamin Squires. Every single song except for the last one, which is Encyclopedia, which is an actual song that we got off of the music bed. But all the music is done by Ben Squires, and I don't even know how I got in touch with Ben. I think I got a recommendation from somebody else. I'm pretty sure that's how it was. And I contacted him, and I was like, hey, man, would you be interested in doing the score? You know, everything had sort of a theme because we were – originally, I think in the script, it was going to be more obvious that the hotel was sort of like this underground club kind of thing. But due to, you know, budget and things like that, we could only do what we could do in the background sound. So I contacted Ben and I sent him the script. And there were all of these. He sent me back all the songs that came back with that were labeled with lines from the movie, like Can't Hold Your Chemicals. And it was just really great. Like, he just loved the script. And I had a joy putting them in the movie. They just fit. Like, I never had to ask him to sort of mold songs to a certain scene. They just fit. They just came out like that, like first take. And they were amazing. And so I just kept putting them. Sometimes I would put them in the scene directly that to what was referenced by the title, where I was just like, this works perfectly for that scene. Just put it right in there. Sometimes it didn't work that way. But I think for a lot of the soundtrack, it did. And then the opening song that you hear from in the opening minutes, and it gets repeated over and over again. It's actually varied with instruments.
Yes.
That was a theme. That was actually the theme of the movie, and he also wrote that. And I asked him if I could get sort of a theme. And originally, I didn't know if it was going to work, having that theme in there, just sort of to get it to differentiate a different mood than the rest of the film. But the theme that he wrote, which was very simple, but it was very effective, just worked. And like I said, that's just due to Ben's genius. He is absolutely fantastic as a composer. And once I found that version that I liked, I was like, well, can you do it with can you do an electric guitar version? Well, can you do this kind of version? And he just kept sending them to me, and they all worked. And it just, his music made the movie. Once we had that music, we had a movie, basically. I mean, the movie looked great, and it was acted well. But once we got that music, I was like, this is it. Now we've got a hit.
That's great. No, I did notice the thing. He kept changing. Like, is that the same song, or is that like, just good thing you clarified?
Yeah, it's the same song, just I done just with different instruments or different modes. I think there's an acoustic version and there's an electric guitar version.
Absolutely, it's very noticeable. I did notice it constantly. I'm like, I think that's the same song, but it's different again. So I was like, I'm gonna have to ask. What is a flying dog?
Flying Dog is a local brewery, local to Frederick, which is where I currently reside. They do they're sort of a big deal around here. And, because I was shooting this in Frederick and I wanted to have some sort of flavors of Frederick in there. I got in touch with them and asked if they would be, okay with us putting their brand in the movie, and they were. And so, that's just a little bit of local flavor around here.
See, it's in my notes. What is a flying dog? I didn't know what it was. The bartender makes a comment when they leave the bar. Now, was that in the script, or was that him making his own comment?
No, that was in the script.
Because I wasn't sure. I'm like, that could have been freestyle. That was kind of like just the way it came out.
Yeah, it was very much a... I think I love little things like that because, you know, they tell you not to put things like that in the script, but, because you know, then it's another person that you have to cast. It's another person that you have to there. Any sort of speaking role is ill advised in a movie, especially in a movie that only has a $4,000 budget. But I love those kind of little asides, because it makes the world feel more real.
Oh yeah, for sure it does.
Yeah, and so I write these little roles in there. That's sort of where Seymour came in from, and that's definitely where the bartender came in from, and just these little roles that we can sort of put out there to make that world feel lived in. Otherwise, it just sort of screams indie film, and your movies are already going to do that based on budget and limitations and things like that. So the more that you can sort of add value to the world, story-wise, the more people are going to forgive the fact that, you know, the bar's not entirely full. You know, it's not necessarily like this, you know, it's not Cheers, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I was fine with the bar not being full. I mean, that's fine.
Right,
every bar is busy.
It's a quiet night at the bar, but like I said, without, you know, Tom's performance and, you know, as this bartender is sort of like watching this thing go on, like you're watching also for his reactions.
Yes.
It just makes it feel more lived in.
I agree. I'm totally with you on board on that. 100% on board.
And that way you don't have to like, cause we literally had very few extras. I think we had, one guaranteed extra, and my friend Mark Scott, who came down, he was our first extra and showed up on time, and he was like, I'm ready to be in the bar. And yeah, I think he's in the first shot. He's on the left-hand side of the screen. He's just drinking his beer alone.
You're right. Oh, my God. I missed him. Yes, there is one guy there. I'm thinking back now. Go ahead. There was very little extras in your film, so I didn't make many notes on it.
So Mark Scott is there, and then we had these two guys who we literally pulled off the street, and a third person, I think, that we pulled off the street, and they were in there. We didn't have much. But, you know, you got to do what you got to do. And then so Tom showed up, and I was just like, we're going to make this work. And it just, his performance, and Tom's not an actor by any stretch, but he loves to ham it up. And he just, I think anybody, the situation was easy to sort of adapt to when you're hearing this dialogue and you're like, you know, you're a bartender. You're hearing this conversation going on. And as a bartender, you just hear things. My best friend was a bartender, and he would tell me stories of things like that. And so I sort of was channeling that in the script. And Tom has, you know, just sort of naturally reacted to Lauren and Paul, and it just worked out great. It was really funny, and it was really fun to do down in that bar. The bar is also local. It's called Wagged. That's local to Frederick. So we just had the whole run to place to ourselves because the bar is closed on Sundays. And we just took one Sunday morning and knocked it out. It was really great. It was a lot of fun.
Okay. My next note, I can't believe your main guy forgets something in his car.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of strange. You're kind of like, really? He planned this whole evening. Obviously, I don't know the end yet, so you got to see what I'm thinking at this time. Going, really?
Yeah. It was sort of like, there are certain things that were a gamble in the script where you were just like, I hope the audience is going to follow you there. And there's just little things where you sort of have to stretch the believability. But it also gives me, I also knew that I was going to have certain moments where I would have to dive out of the room because you couldn't, as much as we could have that hotel room.
I agree.
We're in there for a very long time.
You're there for a good chunk, 75% of the film probably?
Sort of retention. You had to just like, a few times you got to push the eject button. So that was one of the places where I felt like, especially since I knew went in the outline that for, I think it was like 20 good solid pages, we were going to be in that hotel room just nonstop. So I was like, okay, let's hit the eject button right here and give these people a break. And then you can do the same thing using the bathroom. Several times and see more. And so giving these little like checkpoints in the script allowed me to just like, okay, we've been in this room way too long. Hit the eject button. And just little things like that. So it was more important to get them out of the room in order to give us a place to go rather than like, you know, constantly have the camera with them or have it be waiting in the hotel room, say. It would have been much easier for that, but it was much more important to the script and the story to be able to have that eject point right at that moment.
I did have a point in my notes. I was wondering who the woman was calling all the time. Obviously, I do know at the end of the film who she's calling, but that was definitely running through my head constantly.
Well,
And I'm glad you tied it up at the end because I would have been really upset if you didn't.
Yeah, I play with the concept of the film. I play with the very large conceit of what's happening. I play with that constantly. And
you
I think
do.
There's a lot of different things where people are like, that's not something that normally, like a prostitute would do, or that's not what I would do in that situation. But then it comes back around at the end and you're like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
It all made sense in the end. I'm giving you full credit, but I'm just going through my notes, telling you what I'm thinking as I watch it.
Yeah, I was doing that on purpose.
Okay, like, I thought you were.
There's a certain amount of winking that you do with the audience where you're just like, this doesn't, why? Like,
yes.
You know what I mean? It was
100%. I kept writing down why, constantly in my head. There's notes here saying why.
Right, and then when it gets tied up at the end and you have these questions and you're like, oh, it just makes that ending so much more satisfying.
Absolutely.
A lot of people hit that ending and they're just like, oh, that makes so much, oh, okay, oh. And the movie was designed so that at the end, because of that wrap up, like you're turning it around and the people immediately want to talk about it. They're like, okay, and that's so, and then, all right, yeah, okay, yeah. And I wanted this movie to be something where, like, even though it was a $4,000 movie, I wanted to give people a reason to talk about it and then go back and say, hey, you got to see this film, and then talk about it with their friends. And that's actually started to happen.
That's great.
Friends of mine have seen the movie, and they were like, you got to watch this movie. A friend of mine made this movie, and I want to know what you think. And so a lot of people, like, do it, and it just sparks this discussion. Because I do want, ultimately, I do want to see marriage and want to see sort of the life of a couple, you know, the sex life of a couple after you get married, and how society sort of has these, you know, sort of stipulations of what you can and can't do as a married couple. And it's like, why does anybody get any sort of like, say over what you do in your married bedroom? Like, what is that about? Why do you get an opinion over what kind of sex that I get to have with my wife? Like, why, what is that about? So there's a bit of that conversation in there. And I wanted to, there's sort of this stigma of, what is taboo and what is a do and what is a don't in the bedrooms of married people. And I'm just like, why? Who gets to have that opinion? The only person, the only people it should matter to are the people who are in that relationship.
I agree with you.
And so that was, that's sort of like the modus operandi of the movie, where it's just, it's sort of designed to spark that conversation. And I think the movie is able to sort of bring that around. But you have to, you got to play with people first.
You got to set
up the misdirect.
Yeah, I do have, I want to discuss Seymour a bit before we go any further.
Okay.
Why is Seymour the ambassador?
Where
does that come from?
Because I didn't, when I was writing that script, I was thinking about myself, and I was, you know, I didn't, I thought if I were a drug dealer, I would call myself a drug dealer. I would like to think of myself as an ambassador to, you know, so sort of a different experience. And there's that old saying, you know, that drug dealers don't sell drugs, drugs sell themselves.
Correct.
Like, you know, Seymour basically offers this thing, but the decision ultimately comes from Paul's character, whether or not to buy these drugs.
Correct.
And that's just, that's on him. He doesn't make a really hard pitch. And in, indeed, it's like, as soon as he says, Paul says no the first time, he just gives up. He's like, okay, that's it.
Yeah.
You don't want it? That's fine. He's not going to, you know, if he wants drugs, he wants drugs. If he doesn't, he doesn't. Like, it's not going to be something that, you know, he's really going to fight with him over. So I, for me, I always thought if I were, I wouldn't call myself a drug dog. I would call myself an ambassador just so, you know, and then you get, I think as a drug dealer, you sort of have that, that right to be sort of aloof or sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Eccentric, you know.
Okay, I do have one more question. Seymour takes cash or charge?
Seymour has that right to be like a certain amount of eccentric.
Seymour takes cash or charge? Hello?
Yes, he does. Yeah, because I always thought like if you're really smart. You know, if you were really smart as a drug dealer, you wouldn't, you know, wander around with a bunch of cash. I wouldn't want a bunch of cash on me if I were to get stopped by the police. You know, like, I would do it electronically. And, you know, with technology, buy people's car, it doesn't really make any sense for you to be carrying around a bunch of cash so you can be robbed. So for me, it was just like, let's be smart. You're just standing there, like, let him be. You know, if the Girl Scouts can do it, why can't drug dealers?
Yeah, I'm with you. My next question is, you say you're only putting this film on YouTube. Why aren't you trying Amazon Prime? Why aren't you taking to the film festival circuit?
Well, I mean, I'll answer the Amazon Prime question first. The Amazon Prime, has sort of a quality control, and I think we can meet that, but it just, I don't have the sort of, I guess, the staff to make sure that the film is closed captioning, because it, in order to be on Amazon Prime, you have to have closed captioning.
I had no idea.
And
did not know that.
That is a little above, it's a little above my pay grade at this point. And I couldn't pay anybody to do it. I didn't have the money to pay someone to do it. Some people do. So I was just like, well, okay. And my goal for this film was always to put it out for free. I didn't want people to be, it sounds stupid, but I wanted to make money by putting putting things up for free. And I did want to put it up on Amazon originally because you can put it up with ads and then you can get paid off with the ads, but people can still watch it for free. But ultimately, YouTube was sort of where I started because it was like everybody has YouTube on the phone, at work. It's one of those things that gets through the firewalls. Like, you can't do Facebook at work, but you can do YouTube. So that sort of thing. If somebody sends you a link, you know, and you find yourself, like, lounging around at work, it's much easier to get through to people through YouTube than it would be, say, Vimeo or anything like that. Everybody has YouTube. And YouTube also has the right amount of analytics so that you can go through and say, like, oh, where are these views coming from? So it was sort of like the best of all worlds. In terms of festivals, well, I have a personal beef on festivals. Like, this film initially got we wanted to enter it into South by Southwest, and we weren't going to make the deadline, but they gave us a deadline extension because they really enjoyed the script. And so I was really excited about it, but when we sent them the film, they didn't think it was for them. And I was like, okay, well, that's fine. And when you're doing these film festivals, at least the big ones, or the ones that, you know, that you can be proud to tell people, you know, well, it got into Cinequest, or it got into Sundance, or it got into Slam Dance. There's a lot of these films that are being done with much bigger budgets. And I feel like really to sort of stand out, you have to have, like, you know, upwards of like a $50,000 budget. You know, I remember back when Tiny Furniture came out, and, you know, they said they did that for the price of a luxury BMW, and we're just nowhere near that. And so then what you're doing is you're sort of paying to be rejected.
Yeah, I can see
because
that.
Your film doesn't have Hollywood stars, it doesn't have the budget that it would need to sort of get past the gatekeepers, and because you're not operating in a certain budget, you don't have the sort of connections. Because a lot of these films are asked to be to be at the festival. You know, very few films are actually submitted, and so it's just you know, we went through a lot of that. I think I spent $3,000. On my first movie, and we got into exactly two festivals, and I was like, you know what? That to me is a lose-lose game. What I really want to do is I want people to see the movie. So I just want to put it up so that people can watch it, and then I can enjoy, you know, people coming back to me and saying like, oh, I really love this movie. And, you know, I've only had bad festival experiences. I really have. Like, I remember when we first showed this movie, the world premiere of this movie took place at a film festival, a local film festival, and it showed on 5 p.m. on a Friday afternoon.
Ooh.
And it was just the worst time slot ever. And we were in attendance, I think it was myself, my wife, my cinematographer, and the person who did hair and makeup, Joan Jones, who did an amazing job on this film. And it was just us in the theater with, like, I think maybe three other people, and I'm probably exaggerating. It probably was only one or two.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, well, that was not fun, but at least we saw our movie up on the big screen. So, for me, it just, for some people, film festivals seem to work, but I don't seem to have very good film festival luck. I've had screenings of my movies where they've reversed the sound so that, you know, the sound's coming out of the wrong side of the theater. And I've had screenings where they've shown the film in the wrong aspect ratio and the film looks terrible and it's actually laughed at and you're sitting around a bunch of people who are laughing at you, and it's humiliating. And so I don't have good film festival luck, so I will just try direct distributing it to the people.
Perfect. Well, it's time for your fun questions. You all set? Uh-oh. I think I lost them.
Sorry?
Oh, you're still there. Good. It's time for fun questions. You ready? Rob, you there? Okay.
Yes.
Favorite film?
My favorite film, I always used to say Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Really?
That used to be my favorite film of all time. Oh, yeah, really.
I cannot give you that one in any way. I remember seeing it in theaters. Can't say I enjoyed it.
Yeah, the original, the 1990 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles used to be my favorite film of all time. It's a family film. It's an action film. It's all of these different things at once, and it tells this amazing story, and it's this very well acted like movie, but it's got puppets and martial arts. It's so ridiculous. It shouldn't even work.
I agree.
It's so amazing, and I love the artistry of it. And for a while, it was the highest grossing independent film of all time because it was only made for $8 million.
Oh wow!
And it made like almost $200 million. It's so ahead of its time. It used to be my favorite film, but if I really want to like put it out there, I think probably my favorite film is The Breakfast Club. I can watch The Breakfast Club
100 times and still watch it again the next day.
Yeah, I've tried to imitate The Breakfast Club so many times. And I love that it's just, you know, these kids in one location. It is the ultimate one location movie, and it's beautiful, and it's scary, and it's funny, and it has an amazing soundtrack.
Yeah.
I could watch that movie over and over again. It's so great.
I'm with you.
And I love the sort of mythology of how the movie was made and things like that, like how Judd Nelson was actually fired and the rest of the cast actually like rallied to get him back because they knew that he was perfect for that part. And I'm thinking like, wow, what if John Hughes had listened to the cast? What if he just recast Judd Nelson? That movie wouldn't even be the same.
It would
be a completely different thing. Because he's so brilliant in that movie. But yeah, so The Breakfast Club is definitely my favorite movie of all time.
Oh, I'm with you. Don't complain. Okay, it's Friday night. Your friends are over. They want to watch a movie. What do you put on? Is that when we're getting Turtles?
Oh, God. I don't know. I would probably, I don't know. That it depends on what's going on. If I'm with a friend, it's probably something that people haven't seen, or probably that I'm, you know, looking forward to showing people certain things that, like, oh man, have you seen this? If it were probably now, I'd probably put on Get Out.
For sure, no problems there. Great film.
Yeah, because it's just one of those movies where, like, afterwards, it's, you know, sort of, it's going to inspire a lot of conversation, I think.
Yeah, I'm with you. You want something people will talk about.
Yeah, and you know, just like, it has like a, you know, for me, that sort of that swing around ending, which where everything goes into place. It's very topical. It's funny. And it just gives you a lot to talk about afterwards. So if I think, you know, I think that answer will always change, but for right now, it would probably be Jordan Peele's Get Out.
Yeah, no problems at all. Okay. The last one's really easy. You're going to the concession stand. What do you buy at the movies?
Always popcorn and a soda. Always popcorn and soda. I'm sort of a traditionalist on that. Get yourself a Coke, get yourself a big thing of popcorn, and I'm going to enjoy that movie. One of my favorite places on earth is the Alamo Draft House because I don't have to stand in the line. They just bring it to you. I love the Alamo Draft House. I love everything about the Alamo Draft House. It's like church for people who love to watch movies. And you will find me there this weekend to watch
Black Panther.
Black Panther. Oh, I've been waiting for it. I love the Alamo Draft House, and I've been looking forward to this movie. Ryan Coogler, that guy's brilliant. I mean, I saw Creed, and he took what had to be like a $20 million movie, and he was swinging for the fences like it was $100 million. I was looking at that movie and I was like, God, this guy knows what he's doing. And I knew when I heard that he was doing Black Panther, I was like, that's a perfect choice. And everything I've seen about the film, that guy is, he's going to be a legend. I mean, he's he's great. So I'm very much looking forward to Black Panther, and I will be at church, aka the Alamo Draft House, this weekend, for a Valentine's Day screening. and I look forward to it.
So that's it for me. Tell everybody again where they can find your film to watch it.
Well, you can find the film on YouTube. If you search Around the World and Around the World and my name, Rob Hagans, Haganss, you should be able to find it. I'm hoping that as more people see the film, it will be recommended to more people in whatever algorithm that YouTube runs itself on. If you search my name and you search for the film, I should be able to come up with it. That's pretty much, you can also search for it on, facebook.com/aroundtheworldmovie. And you'll come up with the Facebook page, and that also has links to the film. Either one of those ways is be a perfect gateway to the film. And I really hope you guys out there find it. And feel free to send an email back. There's a link in the description of the film on YouTube, and tell me what you think.
Well, thank you for your time, and sorry it was a little late tonight for this.
No, it's okay. It was great. I'm really glad we got a chance to do this.
Awesome. Have a great night.
All right, you too.
Bye.